Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So, good evening, everybody. My name's Tim Besley. I'm a member of the Economics Department here at the LSE. And my role this evening is to chair the second of the three Lionel Robbins lectures that Nick Stern is giving. I'm very pleased to welcome you all, and also our online audience, which I imagine is also extensive, to the Sheikh Zayed Theatre here this evening. I think there were introductions yesterday for Nick, at least, but give my own personal take. Nick has been both a friend and colleague for a long period of time. I've learned a huge amount from Nick, who is both a distinguished academic and someone who's been very active in policy, and not least on the topic of the lectures that he's going to give this evening. It's great that you're all here to listen to him. And the theme of the lectures is a new growth story. And I think the one thing that that I've learned from Nick, perhaps more than anything else, is that there really is no opposition between issues of climate and issues of growth. And I'm sure that's going to be a theme that resonates, that you know, we do face as a nation, as a world, a growth challenge as well as a climate challenge, and it's how we put that together which is absolutely critical. And that's I'm sure is what we're going to hear from today. Nick's CV is far too long and distinguished to rehearse in detail again this evening, but I point out that he's been a chief economist at the World Bank. Was, of course, the main author of the eponymous Stern Report and has been back at the LSE after that policy career for a number of years now, where he's IG Patel Professor of Economics and Government. Among his many distinctions, he was also President of the British Academy. The discussant this evening is going to be Cameron Hepburn, also a very distinguished environmental economist who's the Batuk Professor of Environmental Economics at Oxford University and the Director of the Smith School of Enterprise and Environment. He also serves as the Director of the Economics of Sustainability Program based at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. And we'll hear from Cameron and hear his reflections on Nick's comments. Nick will speak for approximately 45 minutes. Cameron will respond, and then there'll be time for discussion with the audience. For those of you who like to Twitter, I thought we call it X now, but anyway, Twitter, I'll use the old-fashioned terminology. There's a hashtag for LSE Robbins. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast later. Without further ado, I will pass over to Nick. And Nick, thank you very much for giving these lectures.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you, Cameron, for joining us this evening. Thank you all for coming. Always start by checking you can hear me at the back. Very good. The other thing you have to check is that this works, and it does, so we can go. I gave thanks yesterday, which I want to reiterate today, to the Lionel Robbins family and the committee that asked me to give these lectures. Last night's lecture is already on video. All the slides are on the website of the Grantham Research Institute and the Centre for Economic Performance at the LSE. So those are available, they're public goods. The slides are much too detailed for me to go through. They're very deliberately designed so that they can stand by themselves, so that you can read them at your leisure. But it does mean I won't go through them in detail, and I'll go pretty fast through the substance. But anyway, LSE is very selective, so I'm sure you can handle people speaking fast. The LSE colleagues have been a huge part of my life for more than 40 years, and I'm very grateful to all of those, and of course particularly to co authors, some of whom are here, including, I should say, Cameron Hepburn, the discussant. But I would like to thank particularly Delfina Gottfried, Eleonore Souverain, and Roberta Pier Federici and Eva Lee, who helped me greatly in putting these together. Now, yesterday, and I'm not going to summarize, there are summaries in the slides of each of the lectures, but I just want to go directly to the starting point. The starting point is that over the 70 years since the Second World War, the overall level of output or activity went up by a factor of around 13 or so, maybe times 3 for population, a bit over times 4 for output per head, produced in a way which was very heavily dependent on dirty energy, fossil fuels, particularly coal and oil, and then at the end of that period, indeed before the end of that period, we were already seeing the very serious, indeed in many ways catastrophic events, at least catastrophic for small parts of the world. But we now know and understand from the science very clearly that if we run that forward, then we're talking about the potential of catastrophic events for very big parts of the world, indeed for some existential. We are headed on current activities for somewhere around 2.5 or 3 degrees centigrade, and 3 degrees centigrade we haven't seen for something like 3 million years, and at that time sea levels were at least 10 meters, perhaps 20 meters higher than they are now. And of course that's a very small part of the story. You'd be talking about big parts of the world with great risks of temperatures beyond what human beings could stand for more than a few hours outside, extreme weather events and so on. I don't have to go through all that. We had the science yesterday, and we had a very distinguished climate scientist with us yesterday as well in Emily Schockberg. How did we get where we are? Why is it that we've got this constant rise in emissions, and it's still going on rising, and we have to bring it down to net zero? Net zero stabilizes the concentrations and thus stabilizes the temperature. Why has that been happening? We simply have not been investing enough in the new, cleaner ways of doing things. You can't run down the old until you've built the new, and the new is takes investment. So the answer to why we've done badly up to now is we haven't invested enough. And the answer as to where we go from here is we have to invest a lot more. And the growth story is about that investment. How do you stimulate that investment? How do you steer investment in those directions? And that is the growth story, and that's what we'll be developing today. Of course, it's not just the investment in the new. It is changing the ways we do things right across the economy. Designing our cities, using our cities in different ways, creating cities where you can move and breathe and be productive. It's about how we organize our energy and our transport systems. So it's not simply the investment, it's more than the investment. It's structural, systemic, technological change. And indeed, and I'll come to this towards the end of the lecture, it's also behavioral change. So this is the kind of change we're talking about. But if we get it right, it's a very attractive growth story, much, much better than the dirty, destructive models of the past. So that's what we're going to talk about today. It's based on the idea of sustainability that is at the core of this, is to offer to the next generation opportunities at least as good as we had ourselves in this generation. So in that sense, treating future generations symmetrically with our own in terms of their right to development. And the right to development was at the core of what we were discussing yesterday. Did you start to get an echo there just now? Or maybe I'm standing too close to this thing. So this is the new growth story. I've described it in a way that is, I think, correct in that it's very attractive. That doesn't mean that it's easy. We have to do things differently. It involves a lot of dislocation. It involves a lot of investment. But the obstacles now, I think we can see, are in the economy, the politics, and the society much more than in the technology. The technology has been moving remarkably fast, and I'm going to cover that. And lots more technology to come, and we're going to need it. But I think we can see now that it's the economics, politics, and society where the difficulties are going to be there. So let's set off, but I would like, as we set off, since this is about growth, to remember someone who played a huge influence in my life, the great mentor on growth, which is Bob Solow, who very sadly died, but at the age of 99 last December. So the structure of the lectures is I've described a bit of last time, I've described a bit of this time. Next time I'm going to talk much more about the international side of things, so I'll talk less about the international side of things today. So I've given you a feel for the basics of the new growth story, but we'll go into that, what it really means. I'll deal with the suggestion that there's some kind of horse race between climate and development, and I'll deal with that directly. Tim Besley already referred to that. What sorts of investments do we have to do? What does that imply about the kind of analytics we have to bring to bear? What kinds of policies and institutions are going to foster this growth story? And I'll finish on the role of the state, because this is a different role of the state from, at least from the market fundamentalist stories of the 1990s. So here are the drivers of growth. I want to argue, and I'll go through each one of them, that we can think of six interwoven, mutually reinforcing drivers. The first is the whole story of innovation, driving down costs, doing things differently. The second is increasing returns to scale. There's an overlap there between the two, but they are conceptually distinct. The third is resource efficiency. Resource efficiency is productivity, is growth, but you have to invest and change your ways to get that too. The systems part of the story is enormously important. How our cities function is of tremendous importance to health and productivity, and indeed the cheerfulness of life. Energy, transport, crucial systems, so too, of course, land and forests and water. The improved health is going to be a big part of the story. We'll look at some numbers, but that is a huge effect in terms of productivity. But whether or not you take productivity seriously, I hope you do take productivity seriously, I would hope you think that stopping killing people is a very important part of the story, whether or not it influences productivity. And of course, investment itself. If you increase the share of investment, which is what I'll be arguing you have to do, and I've already argued you have to do, then that is itself a driver of growth. So the this is, for these reasons, if you look at what you have to do and what the mechanisms are, this is a growth story. This is a story of growth in the next few years where you sharpen supply and improve demand. We have suffered from demand deficiency as a world over the last decade or so. It launches the whole story of Schumpeterian growth and development. And of course, there is no long-run high carbon growth story. It destroys itself. So what's been happening then, and I'm going to go through these drivers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, very quickly. First, if you look at innovation, the change, and we certainly didn't anticipate that all those years ago when we did the Stern Review, which we started work on, 19 years ago. We didn't spot this coming. But the what you've seen now is across electricity, at least, the clean is cheaper than the dirty. And that's true across an increasing part of the economy and of emissions. Very interestingly, the International Energy Agency, which has been pretty good on all this stuff, has consistently underestimated the pace at which the costs would fall, and that's gone on. That inability to understand the pace at which costs would fall has gone on for quite a long time, although I think they're starting to change now. That's onshore wind, offshore wind, solar. Interestingly, very strong movement in batteries, and we're going to see, I think, many of us would argue, quite substantial technical progress on the battery front. The deployment, that was the cost. The deployment, you can see the deployment in solar has been quite remarkable. China in this last year or so in solar has invested or created about 200 gigawatts or more, a bit more, of capacity compared with the total capacity of the electricity industry in the UK of 80. So just year by year, they've been adding 200 in recent years or more in solar. The deployment's been really very, very fast. And you can see on the right-hand side here that around 4 years or so ago in energy, the investment in the clean overtook the investment in the dirty. So you can see the falling costs and you can see the reaction to that in terms of investment. The problem is that that has been in large measure in the rich countries and in China. That balance of investment has looked very different across the story, and the big reason for that is a number of reasons which we're going to discuss, but one big reason for that is the cost of capital. If you are in Africa, many countries would be facing cost of capital of 20% or more. You're talking about the renewables, the different ways of doing things has been quite capital intensive, and because you're substituting capital up front for the fuel that you're saving down the track, the profitability of that is sensitive to the cost of capital. And what is really competitive, if the cost of capital is reasonable and manageable and the kind of thing that you see in rich countries, is not competitive if your cost of capital is 20% or more. And that has led to what I've just described. You know, you've had very big investment in the advanced countries and in China, but 90% of the increase in clean energy investment has been there, rather than actually in the countries where it's most important, who are shaping their future and looking for a different path of development. So that's a big question. I'll come back to that at much greater length tomorrow, which will be in large measure around finance for poorer countries and how to bring down the cost of capital. I've concentrated up to this point in terms of technology on the electricity. But that movement is coming. Indeed, it's already with us on road transport. Within a year or so, the purchase price for an electric vehicle will be similar to that of an internal combustion engine vehicle. But already, the lifetime cost of electric vehicle is competitive, indeed, in many cases, cheaper than for an internal combustion vehicle. So I've spoken about electricity, spoken about road transport, but that's coming. That's coming in the heating of buildings. We're pretty close now in terms of the competitiveness of heat pumps, and we're not that far away, maybe 7 or 8 years away on green steel and so on. So whereas we can say now that perhaps 30% of the emissions are in areas where the clean is cheaper than the dirty, maybe in 8, 9, 10 years' time, that will be true across something like 2/3 of the emissions. There'll always be other bits which are going to be much more difficult. Aviation is a bit further down the track. Cement will probably stay a problem for a while. Those are areas where we're going to have to think of other ways of doing it. For example, carbon capture and storage and so on would be significant in relation to cement. But that story of the clean becoming cheaper than the dirty is an extremely important one, but always with the qualification that it depends on the cost of capital. So let's move now to increasing returns to scale. I was talking about innovation, new ways of doing things, driving down costs. But differences conceptually with the innovation and new ways of doing things and learning by doing, which were in what I've just been talking about, and increasing returns to scale. The fixed cost element is something which is a genuine returns to scale story. If you have to pay something to set up, then you don't have to pay it again. You can just expand your output. And some of this are their real setup costs, including charging infrastructure for electric vehicles. Sometimes you get increasing returns to scale through the functioning of systems. Now, your telephone is a more valuable thing if other people have got a telephone. There are genuine systemic increasing returns to scale. And how many people here are economists? Oh, that's good. That's a higher fraction than usual, and the rest of you probably could have been. Not all of you, but the rest of you probably could have been. But this is the kind of thing, if you think about the origins of increasing returns. There's sell-up costs, there's the system effects, and here there's some physical things as well. I remember long ago, Nicky Caldor, when I went to his lectures in Cambridge in the 1960s, was very keen on telling us that the cost of the container goes up like the square of the dimension, and the volume of the container goes up like the cube, so you've got some basic increasing returns to scale from the geometry. Well, there's some of this in terms of windmills and so on for wind power. And actually, there's a very nice thing where if you look at the if you look at the wind speed, the amount of electricity you get out of a wind turbine goes up like the cube of the wind speed. So build them big and build them high and build them in places where it's windy. And so there are these physical sides of increasing returns to scale as well. Yeah, then you can you can answer me that question later on. The answer is there are lots of other things that you can use. You can do storage, you can move electricity around across geography and space. But you can answer me that question later on. The next part of the story is resource efficiency. Efficiency is productivity, is growth. Energy intensity is going down, but we can do a lot more by driving the demand side down in that strong way. There is resource efficiency at the system. If you're designing a house, designing communities by integrated design, there's lots of ways in which you can save waste and drive down costs. The whole story of the circular economy is one of those. So that resource efficiency side is a big part of the growth story. System productivity is something I've already mentioned in terms of increasing returns to scale. But a lot of this is not simply the returns to scale from a system like a telephone system. It's also returns to scale in terms of what you can get out of better design of those systems. And there's some nice work which was done by the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate around designing of cities, where you can see that if you have compact and connected cities, there's a very big return to in terms of energy use, and that is reflected in that diagram here, which comes from that work. If you look at urban density and the emissions here, very closely related to energy, you get that very strong downward connection. Sometimes it's represented by comparing, an example is comparing Barcelona and Atlanta, which have the same kind of population, same kind of income per capita, but the energy use from transport in Atlanta is about 10 times as high. And that's an example of the way in which city design and rapid transport systems can change the whole efficiency. The increased share of investment will be a big part of the story. Harrod reminded us very clearly of the importance of investment in driving growth. The technical progress is a big, very big part of the solar story. But if we increase investment rates, that in itself we would expect to increase growth rates. Finally, there's the health story. You can calculate these things in various different ways, but some quite useful studies here, quoting from the World Bank, saying the cost of mortality and morbidity from exposure to PM2.5, it's a measure of the size of the particulates, around 6% of GDP. Now that's in terms of both deaths and increasing in illness, cutting productivity. These numbers are very big, so that again, if you can cut back on that, you're increasing output and growth. So that's the story. It really is a growth story for all the reasons I've described. You do have to invest a lot to get there. You do have to change your systems. You do have to change your structures. With that investment increase, you have to manage the macro and the public finance. There's dislocations along the way, which you have to manage too. This isn't easy, but the returns to doing it are very high in terms of the kind of growth that you can see. Not growth forever, but we're talking about the next 20 or 30 years. And of course, the cost of not doing it, the cost of walking away, is absolutely immense. So let me now address directly the idea that there's some kind of horse race between climate and development. I've already spoken quite explicitly about action on climate driving growth. So that is one part of the story. We should also integrate it with adaptation, because we can see from the temperature increases we've already seen and what's coming that we live in a climate that's much more violent than went before. We're going to have to build in a more resilient way. We're going to have to adapt. That's a big part of the story right across the board. And it's very important to recognize not only is there not a horse race between climate and growth, also we can think of adaptation and mitigation, those actions as well, being part of the story of development. Indeed, good adaptation is always good development. It makes no sense to pursue your infrastructure and your agriculture as if climate isn't changing when climate is changing. So good adaptation is good development. But there are quite a lot of, here I give five examples of the ways in which development, adaptation, mitigation are integrated. Mangroves, I'm not going to go through them all, but mangroves provide barriers to storm surges, very strong at capturing carbon, and they help with fisheries. Similarly, restoring degraded land. Obviously, that increases productivity, it makes you more resistant to difficult weather, and it stores carbon. So there are many examples, public transport is another, of how those three things come together. Inaction on climate is extremely bad for well-being right across the board. Health in terms of losses of output, exposure to insect-borne disease, the direct physical damage, the impacts through food systems, and impacts through migration and conflict. Many people would, if we let it go to 2.5-3 degrees, hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of people would have to move because where they were would be uninhabitable. So inaction clearly increases poverty and reduces growth. Now, there are quite a lot of arguments which I've sort of listed down the left-hand side here as to say, well, surely there must be some kind of trade-off between climate and development. And there's one that says, I haven't got time to go through all of them here, but there's one that says that in an efficient world, if you have a climate which is, if you have a criterion which is different from the one that you had before, in an efficient world, then you have to give up on something else. Of course, the big assumption there is that the world is efficient, and we're going to go through a whole load of crucial inefficiencies here, which actually climate action can help overcome, or at least the motivation to do the climate action can help overcome. There's an argument that says development needs energy, and that's right, but energy doesn't need carbon. There's an argument that says using resources for climate action will reduce those resources going elsewhere. So that's extremely important then to align the climate action and the investment for climate action with the growth story, and I've described exactly how you can do it. There is, the fourth one though has more substance. The fourth one here says that this kind of change and the changes in relative prices, the changes in activities will have effects on dislocation, and that's going to point us, and I'll come back to it, that's going to point us directly to the kind of policies that you have to pursue. So the reasons that we haven't moved so fast are in part to do with this perceived horse race or trade-off between climate and development, and that's why it's so important to address it directly. But I've already mentioned, secondly, the importance of affordable finance and how for much of the developing world that's been difficult. The dislocation have led people to back off. Vested interests have opposed. Economic analyses have left out a lot of the crucial benefits, including to future generations. So there is a story that we have to look at. The story is critical to share the ideas and to discuss all this properly, because we have been moving too slowly, and it's very important to understand the reasons for that. What kind of investment are we talking about here? Well, here I'm just going to offer you some numbers which my colleague Amar Bhattacharya and others have put together about the scale of investment that we're going to need to pursue the very different paths that we've been describing. And that's about, for emerging markets and developing economies other than China, on a flow basis for 2030, we're talking about numbers in the region of $2.4 trillion a year as a flow of investment. And the big bulk of that, and the energy transition, but also adaptation and resilience, loss and damage, natural capital, and the just transition. This is a big investment story. The numbers are really substantial. And that investment has to be financed, and I'm going to say quite a lot about that tomorrow, particularly the flow of finance to emerging markets and developing economies. And the cost of that is in large measure around risk, so we have to think hard about how we work to reduce that risk. In terms of percentage of GDP, you can see the climate-related investment that we're talking about here for those countries does involve an increase from about 2.5% of GDP at the levels before the pandemic to something close to 5% by 2030 in terms of what we would need to do to have the investment flows necessary for the kinds of activities that I've just described. So that's a big macro effect. That is a serious increase in investment. It's not the increment relative to some business as usual, because it's hard to describe what your business as usual would be. So that 2.4 to 4.8 in the bottom line percent here is an increase over time that we would need to have. It's not an increase relative to what might otherwise have happened. It's perfectly possible. What you'd be talking about is investment rates, not so very different from what they might have been 20 or so years ago, in a world where over this last 15 years or so, we've been seeing a deficiency of effective demand. What sort of investment? Electrification will be absolutely fundamental. We will need in the UK, as we switch our activities from, say, internal combustion engines to electric vehicles, from gas boilers to heat pumps and so on, we're going to need three times the electricity capacity by mid-century here in the UK. In India, which of course has got a very big growth story going on, you'd be talking about five times the electricity capacity and all clean electricity. So that's a major part of the story, and the decarbonisation of the energy intensive sectors is going to large measure depend on electricity too. To some extent it will come through green hydrogen, perhaps some biofuels, but in large measure it's going to be electrification. So that's a big part of the story. Agriculture has its own problems, and that's something where the different ways of doing things are going to be very important. Regenerative agriculture will be a very big part of that story. That means covering the ground with crops, disturbing the soil in a minimal way, drilling, no-till drilling and so on. There's a great deal that we can understand that we have to do there, but that will be a major problem of agricultural change. So that investment would be very important. The pressure, of course, on the land is associated with diets as well. Diets are likely to change. All these things will be a big part of a real recasting of the way in which we do things. And that's going to be very sensitive, as we've seen in many countries, particularly in Europe in recent months. The forest part of the story, again, I'm keeping an eye on the time. How long have I got left?
I would say about another 8 minutes.
Okay. So I'm not going to dwell on the forest story, but clearly that is a big part of what really matters. And again, the incentive structures around that is very important. We're actually quite fortunate, and we've been unfortunate in many ways in this whole story as a world, but the fact that artificial intelligence has started to move just at the time when we need to move strongly in the green direction is really important. The AI is going to be helpful in managing the systems, as I've described, discovery and development of new technology. It's already having some payoffs in nuclear fusion. It'll be very important in understanding how different kinds of extreme weather events affect different places. A whole area of acting, including behaviour also. This is an area where actually we've been reasonably lucky, but of course it means that the priorities for artificial intelligence should be moving in those directions rather than trying to interrupt our computer activity to sell things that we don't want. So the analytics of the new growth story, well, I've already been describing the kinds of changes that we have to make. And what I want to press here is the idea that that's where economists should be spending their time and their energy, on the system change, on thinking about tipping points where the clean becomes cheaper than the dirty, the kind of applications of artificial intelligence and digitization that I've described, helping manage the dislocations that are going to come as part of this whole story. So that is a whole research area which I think it's fair to say economists have been very slow to pick up. Indeed, a lot of their models have suffered from underestimation of risks, of really excluding the whole story of learning by doing and innovation and cost reduction. And they've also, and I went into this yesterday, I won't do it again today, is that they've been really muddled in terms of discounting. I did do the theory of discounting in two slides yesterday, and I recommend you go and have a look at them. It's actually quite simple if you go back to the basics. So what we've had is an economics in many ways that has been misleading in what they do include. You know, they've underestimated the risks, they've overestimated the costs and so on. But particularly important, they've been misleading on what they do not include. And that's this whole story of systems change, which structural change, the dynamics that change, the dislocation and so on. So the what we have to do then is address ourselves directly to the kinds of problems of structural, systemic, technological change, the kind of problems of dislocation that I've tried to draw attention to here. And that's a new agenda for economics. I think it's fair to say the economists are starting down that road. Cameron Hepburn is indeed one of those, but it's been too slow. And I think we've actually let down the world and our profession. And fortunately, I think we're finally moving in the right direction. So, last part of what I want to say, well, I might need another 7 or 8 minutes. I'll do my best. The policies and institutions and then the role of the state. The signals that we give are about signals for investment. Expectations, whether you are a student of Keynes or von Hayek, I hope actually of both, expectations are absolutely central to the investment process. So the credibility of policies is of fundamental importance. It's no good having one policy and then suddenly changing your mind and switching. If investors see that kind of behavior, they won't invest. So credibility is crucial. I like to use the language of predictably flexible. The predictability is not rigidity. But you have to say in advance when you set a policy, what will be your reasons for changing? It'll be around the diffusion of the technology, the fall in cost, and so on. It's actually quite analogous to the way in which central banks proceed. They indicate the criteria under which they'll change their policies. So credibility will be very important. Now here, this is for the economists here, but I think there's six very big market failures that we're going to have to tackle when we're thinking about policy and the dynamics of policy here. The greenhouse gas, of course, is the one that we all think of, and people think of a carbon price. But there's R&D, there's the imperfection in capital markets, there's the functioning of networks, there are challenges of information and asymmetry of information, and there are the very big co-benefits of action, which I've pointed to in health. All of these are very substantial market failures that require public policy. Down the right-hand side, I've described the kinds of public policies that are necessary here, and I won't go into any detail. But it's a serious mistake to think that the only relevant market failure here is in the externality associated with greenhouse gases. So the public policy has to pick up those market failures. It has to think about acceleration and pace. It has to think about the public finances, and it has to be very clear, and we have to be very clear, that investing in ways which drive growth, bring down costs, protect the future, is wise, fiscally responsible investing. So whilst it's extremely important in the public finances to cover in a strong and sustainable way current government expenditure, borrowing to invest is eminent sense and indeed is fiscally responsible. Borrowing to invest in a strong way with high returns will bring down your debt to GDP ratios. But our analysis has to cover all these areas, from the market failures to the dynamics of change to the dislocation to the way in which we measure fiscal responsibility and so on. All that is going to be something where I think economists are now stepping up, but there's much more work to do. Behavioural changes will be very important. I've emphasised this is taken from the IPCC Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, looking at the effects of different kinds of diets. But it's the way in which we drive, the way in which we heat our homes, how much we do our recycling. All those are issues around behaviour which are very important. The institutions and legal structures matter enormously to expectations around investment. Tim Besley here is a member of the National Infrastructure Commission. Now, having clear understandings of the way in which infrastructure is going to go will be a very big part of the investment process. The legal frameworks that we use, and great work being done at the Grantham Research Institute on the legal frameworks and the confidence they give. Just one example, in Delhi, the Supreme Court ruled that you have a right to breathe, and they said that you had to switch away from diesel engines for the auto rickshaws to the compressed natural gas, and those are now switching over to electricity. So those were actions of the courts in enforcing individual rights. The whole set of issues, whether you're talking about infrastructure commission, a development finance institution, the kind of example I've given in terms of the auto rickshaws in Delhi, and of course education and how we understand our relationship to the world, the environment in which we live, all those are a big part of the institutional process. We have to deal with a just transition. I've already mentioned it. I can't go into any detail here. Let me keep the final things what I want to say about the role of the state. Now, in the 1990s, in the market fundamentalism, the idea was just the state should get out of the way, just get the macro right, get prices right, and let investment fall where it may. Now, it's clear now that that's not a tenable position, because we have a clear understanding of the way in which investment has to move. And that means that we have to think about the state that tries to foster the kind of investment which I've just described. Lionel Robbins himself, who, of course, spent time in the war in the economic section of the Cabinet Office, and he was very much, actually, an Austrian sort of Mont Pelerin free market school, he saw very clearly that there are times when you have to invest in change in order to protect the rights of the future. And that's very much the kind of position which we're in now. The entrepreneurship of investors is going to be absolutely central here, because you have a state which is trying to help move investment in a certain direction does not mean that the state has to do all that investment. It has to help shape that sense of direction. It has to give the confidence, and we've seen that from the Paris Agreement, the confidence that flows from having a sense of direction drives down your costs. We have to have a role of the state which understands the role of global public goods, the sense that the emissions from any one country are going to damage the the development and the rights to development of other countries. So that's something where you have to integrate that into your national processes. I'll be talking about the international side tomorrow. All this, and this is the last slide here, institutions, of course, affect behaviour. Understanding what is responsible, agreeing on what our values and objectives and metrics are. That is a big part of the story as well. So what I've tried to do is to set out why this is such an attractive path to follow, emphasise how difficult it's going to be in many respects, but that those difficulties can be overcome. But that does mean a different understanding of the role of the state from the extreme versions of market fundamentalism of the 1990s. I do think that that understanding of the role of the state is moving in the direction I'm describing, but it's got quite a long way to go. So come back tomorrow for the international side of things. Let me stop here, and it's Cameron's turn, and then we'll have questions.
Good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me to kick off the discussion, and what a rich, grounded but optimistic lecture, just exactly the sort of thing that we expect from Professor Stern. So I wanted to, there's so much in there, I'm just going to try and pick at a few different points. The key message, or one of the key messages to take away, for me at least, is that over the next decade, we're going to need a lot more investment. That investment is attractive, but it has an implication. More investment means less consumption. So more insulation, fewer frappuccinos. And so this is the sort of thing that we need. And we need the state to provide expectations, to provide the confidence to shape private sector expectations to make that investment work. And I wanted to tee up what I was going to say with a couple of quotes for you. And I'd like you to work out, not shout out, just work out quietly in your head, who said this? So here's the first one. Unless we act now, not some time distant, but now, these consequences, disastrous as they are, will be irreversible. So there's nothing more serious, more urgent, or more demanding of leadership. That's quote one. No shouting. Bill Gates, I heard you, but it's not quite right. Have a think. The second one. I would, frankly, be reluctant to give up my holidays abroad. I personally think it'd be a bit impractical, actually, to expect people to do that. I think if we set people unrealistic targets, if we say to people that we're going to cancel all the cheap air travel, I'm still waiting for the first politician who's actually running for office who's going to come out and say it, and they're not. All right, so have a think, who said that? Now, some of you probably know. I'm sure Nick knows at least one of those. The first statement about the urgency, the demands of leadership, was Tony Blair in October 2006, at around the point of the Stern Review. The second statement was Tony Blair in early 2007. And I contrast those two quotes because they sum up the essence of what we need to do. We know we need to do it. We know we've got to do it. But at least in 2007, we didn't want to do it. And I think what we've heard tonight is that a lot has changed since 2007. It's 2024. Emissions rose, but now they're plateauing. But the key thing that's changed, the reason I feel optimistic about this agenda, is the crux of this lecture. Those six drivers of the new growth story, the induced innovation, now that I've started listing them, I'm going to get in trouble, learning by doing, increasing returns, system productivity, resource efficiency, and new forms of investment. And that's why those dynamics are saving us here. Luckily, the oil and gas and the coal industry do not benefit from these dynamics. And the clean technologies mostly do, not all of them, but some of them do. And I say luckily because I'm not sure there's any God-given reason that humanity has got this get out of jail card, but we do. And I think where that leaves us in a situation where we are getting it wrong time and time again. Nick, you put up the chart with the IEA's forecasts, and everybody loves to kick the IEA. But it's not just them. I think it's most of humanity fails to understand how exponential or combinatorial processes work. So if you think about the last big combinatorial process or exponential process that we faced, it was the spread of COVID. And I don't know how many of you know others who are perhaps not mathematically inclined, and their reactions were, many of them were, I don't see it anywhere, it's not happening. And it was nowhere, and then it was everywhere. Right? These things change very quickly because of the underlying mathematics, and humans are not wired to really instinctively get compound interest. Now, I saw how many hands went up as to who the economists are, so I know you guys do get compound interest. But you're weird, and so am I, and we are not normal sorts of people. Most people do not understand these sorts of processes. I meant that in a positive way, by the way. I mean, we're weird in a good way. Okay, so Nick has really set out the core of the case for optimism. He said it wouldn't be easy, and it's not, but it is also very attractive because it is. You do the numbers, and this looks like a complete no-brainer. And I think it is a complete no-brainer. But I just wanted to, before I sit down, address a few of the whatabouts. Because I know, if they're not on your minds, they'll be on the minds of listeners around the world online. And, so isn't this too good to be true? We've got a story here of investment in technologies that are improving very quickly, that save human civilization, prevent extinction of millions of species, sort out our health, increase our productivity. Can it really be true? So here's a few whatabouts that I get all the time. What about the grid? It's not going to be able to handle all of this stuff going on. Just, sure, panels are getting cheaper, turbines are getting cheaper, but we can't connect them all up. And that's a good challenge. It's not a trivial challenge. Nick didn't kind of dive into it. And we could spend hours on it. But I feel fairly positive here. You see the Windsor, Nick Windsor's review here in the UK. There are similar changes in planning regimes elsewhere around the world. But also technology is helping to overcome some of what were kind of social and political issues. You've got cables now, instead of being built out of steel, are constructed from carbon fiber and aluminium that can take 2 or 3 times as much power down the same line. So instead of having to go through a 10-year consent process to put in a new transmission line, you simply change the cable in a line that's already there. What about the grid? I think we can do the grid. I'm not saying it's easy. Nick wasn't saying it's easy, but it can be done. What about storage? So there's a gentleman up the front who said, but the wind doesn't blow. Yes, it doesn't. And the sun doesn't always shine. That's also true. But Nick put up some impressive charts on progress in batteries. That will help a large part of the world. Tragically, perhaps, in this glorious country with its wonderful weather, I'm Australian originally, batteries won't help us so much because they're great for the day-night solution, but not so great for the middle of the British winter in January when you don't have any sun, really, to speak of. And there can be periods of 2 or 3 weeks where there's no wind as well. How do you run an industrialized economy on that? What about that? That's often put as a kind of slam dunk, you can't do it. Well, I would draw your attention to a report by the Royal Society, led by Sir Chris Lund-Smith, on large-scale electricity storage, where he shows how this can be done, even for a country as blessed as the UK. What about critical minerals? Don't we have to mine the entire Earth to make this story that Nick set out true? No is the answer. Yes, there are going to be supply chain disruptions, already have been. Yes, there'll be price spikes. Yes, we will have a bunch of challenges with mineral processing. We've already got notable concentration within parts of the value chain in one country. And that is worrying people. But there's no fundamental shortage of the minerals that we need. And one thing that's worth bearing in mind, which I found stunning, is that if you contrast a pure fossil system with a pure clean system and ask how much stuff are we extracting from the Earth for this one versus this one? Yeah, this one you've got to extract stuff, yes. But this one you're extracting close to 100 times more stuff. This one is the fossil one. This one is the clean one, in case. In fact, that probably didn't help you if you were just listening. So the fossil system requires at least 10, perhaps 100 times more extraction of material from the Earth in order to run to power our economies. I could go on, but I won't, because I think I'm out of time, aren't I, Tim? Or shall I go on?
No, I think it's a good time to...
All right.
We'll bring you back into the discussion, unless you've got anything you're burning
to say. I will wrap up
with
one final para, and this is on cost. What about cost? And I think there was a question yesterday. What's it all going to cost? And in a sense, Nick answered those questions today. You saw the numbers on the scale of the investment. Now, the net cost... You know, most of this room is economists. You can subtract one number from the other, right? There are benefits, there are costs. You subtract the cost from the benefits, and you get some sort of net benefit situation. Don't know if you could probably manage that. So the net costs are big, and they're negative. The costs are the investment costs, the amount of you have to put in up front. You saw the numbers tonight. They're single-digit percentage points of GDP. Probably in the 1 to 2 range, perhaps a bit more, perhaps, you know, maybe they'll turn out to be less. And then you're saying, what are we getting for that investment? What's the payoff? Well, I hope it was clear from this evening. It's not just, you know, reduced waste and cleaner energy, as much as that is helpful. The air pollution costs 6% on average of GDP, up to 10% in some countries. If you care about non-human species, you get a few of them. And if you care about human civilization, you get that too, thrown into the mix as a bit of an extra bonus. And if you want to have a look at all of the avoided costs by investing in the story that Nick has set out tonight, there's a nice piece in Scientific American, a visual that I could draw your attention to, you can Google, of all the damages that we're avoiding. So is it worth it? Is it worth it to protect human civilization? Well, I don't know, I leave that to you. I think it's hard to conclude. It's not a no-brainer. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Cameron. Before I turn to the floor, I'd like to pose a question to both of you. You both, Nick, glossed over the just transition material. I know you had stuff on this. But how do you see, some people will say there's a cost in terms of equality and adverse distributional effects. Could you just flesh out, perhaps both of you, you know, how you, do you see a tension? Or do you think this can also be done in a way that can cope with some amount of distributional dislocation? How do you see that?
Without policy, there is a tension. And I did go through that slide where, you know, I went through sort of four suggestions that there must be, as it were, a horse race or a trade-off between climate action and development. And the first three, I think, you could say are just sort of straight wrong in terms of not understanding that we live in a very inefficient economy, so that you can't lean on an argument that has efficiency as its core. But the last one, the fourth one I had there, is about dislocation. And there could easily be major tensions there unless you have good policy. So that's really asking ourselves, if we make these changes, and some activities, for example, like coal mining, are stopped, what happens to the people who are earning their living in coal mines? I've heard the head of Mercedes give a talk saying, we always look after our workers well, we will simply start making electric vehicles and we'll bring them all together. So essentially they'll just be doing different things, but they'll still be working for Mercedes. And he said, of course, we do actually buy in our pistons and other things from outside, and of course they'll have a problem. So what you have to do is to understand which areas are going to go down, and of course alongside which areas can go up. And you have to invest in people and places. And that's the most important thing of all, to have an investment so that those alternative opportunities are created in locations which are hit particularly hard. Other parts of the story will have to do with price changes. Now, carbon-intensive areas will have price rises. So there'll be some people where that will hit their budgets particularly. Then it's very important to use your revenue to more than compensate those. So that's the one area where direct public policy is extremely important if those tensions are to be avoided. And that's our job. I mean, as people trying to work out public policy, good community, of course, it's critical that they're involved in that, in defining what the problems are and methods of change. But that is a whole area of dislocation and just transition is enormously important. There are higher costs of capital for poorer people. Some of this involves investment. So managing those costs of capital, those costs of capital can be part of the story as well. So it's a major challenge, but there are answers to all those questions.
Excellent. I don't know if you want to add anything on that, Cameron.
I agree entirely. I just added some numbers, perhaps. Nick dealt with the international dimensions of the just transition. At the local level, one of our doctoral students, Joris Booker, has been looking at job gains and losses from the transition. He's not yet published his paper yet, so I don't want to steal too much of his thunder. Some of you may know that there's around 50,000 jobs, direct jobs in the US coal sector. So obviously they go. Some of you may also know that month-to-month shifts in non-farm payroll in the US economy can go up and down by 300,000 in a month. So to get a sense of the scale of the jobs lost versus the noise in the US economy, he's been also doing a study of jobs, net jobs gained. I mean, there's been a long-standing understanding, recognition that there are more jobs in a clean system than a dirty system in aggregate, but we haven't had much granularity about where they are, how politically sensitive they are, what are the wage rates, what skills, what occupations. And so Joris is doing a very, very detailed study of that and finding some very interesting things that really go to the point Nick just made, that while the scale necessarily isn't huge and while the net gain really is there, we will need some careful policy to make sure that everybody is better off, but we can do it.
Great. So we will now open up to the floor, and I'll maintain the equality theme in the following sense, that I ask everybody to be extremely brief. If not, that will limit the number of people who can get into the conversation. So I really do ask anyone who's going to speak to keep it brief, to the point, and then we'll be able to get plenty of people in. So over there first, but please, as I say, keep it very brief.
Yeah, we'll be brief.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you very much. I'm Piers Corbin from weatheraction.com, long-range forecasters. I'm a physicist, astrophysicist, and I'm also a candidate for mayor under Peace Now London. And gentlemen, the first point I want to ask is, are you not aware that over 20,000 years, carbon dioxide levels follow changes in temperature? So the theory of man-made climate change is false. Carbon dioxide is the gas of life. We want more, not less, and the greenhouse theory is also fake physics. But you might not want to agree with that, because of course you're told there's jobs to be had. But I want to ask you gentlemen a question. Surely, don't you think that looking around the world at the problems, the increased bloodshed we've got in the Ukraine, in Palestine, in the Yemen, and we've got British and Russian troops fighting now in Ukraine. Don't you think the threat of war, bloodshed, is more important and a bigger danger than CO2? So really, shouldn't we concentrate on this instead of going on this actually delusional stuff. Peace now is the most important thing, because all of this could count for nothing if we have a world war.
You made your point.
Yes, I will end there. Thank you very much for listening.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take the comments and questions in batches of three. That was our first. So can we... Yeah, over here, please. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Ami Kotecha. I'm an alumna of LSE. Question for both of our panelists. Clean is, in terms of investment and cost of capital, responding to that, and I brought this up yesterday briefly with Nick as well. Clean today is actually not valued in the same way as dirty as far as investment is concerned, despite this optimistic picture. And a lot of that is driven by the fact that when you look at private capital flows, they're more interested in the shorter term, in terms of, you know, the horizon for investment is shorter than when we can see all these benefits, and the cost of dirty is actually undervalued, and the benefit of clean is undervalued. How do we actually change that and make more capital flow into clean?
Thank you. And a third, I'm sorry, it was the first one I saw there. We will have time to go for another round, but the first person I saw was there in the middle. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Stern, for the presentation. I'm Fernando, a master's student of environmental economics of London School of Economics. I'm working for an NGO that is advising right now the Congress of Mexico on an environmental policy. We're trying to identify a national standard guideline to understand the value of ecosystemic services, to identify and measure through a geospatial model the relevant variables, including non-market values, which later on will be suggested as a national standard. And finally, to propose an ecosystemic net compensation in order to find more sustainable alternatives of development growth. As you were mentioning, we need a structural transformation policies. So my main question, it's like we have this concern of how to quantify these ecosystemic services. So if you can share some of your advices from your vast experience, that would be really useful. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. So I'll come back to Nick, and Cameron may have something to throw in as well. So
yep. On the first question, climate science is about 200 years old if you go back to the very early papers of Fourier, and it's developed in a very strong and clear way over those 200 years. If you've got some new results which you'd like to publish, I think you should send them to the scientific journals.
Yeah, and if you can get them on weatheraction.com, the scientific paper's already there, spelling out the facts that CO2 levels...
Yeah,
okay,
thank you very much.
Please... False physics of the greenhouse effect. Yeah. Please, people, read it.
Thank you very much. I would encourage you to submit those to the scientific journals and have them properly peer-reviewed, and you've got 200 years of climate science, which is extremely serious. You're in a very small one.
I know it.
You know it, and you've said it, and that's enough. Thank you.
I'm 200 years.
Yeah, and you've also spoken about the importance of peace in the world, and I don't think that any of us would want to... disagree about the importance of that. How to get there, of course, is a very different thing, but that's not what we're talking about today. But I don't think any of us, would want to disagree about that, the importance of avoiding and settling conflicts. On the valuation of the clean in the investment markets, now, the idea that it's not and that there's no returns in the clean is actually contradicted by the very strong investments that I set out, particularly in rich countries and in China, a very big part of it in the private sector. The response to the clean being cheaper than the dirty in terms of investment in the clean has been very strong, at least in those areas which I described. So I think you put it in too stark a way, because it's in contradiction to the evidence that people are actually doing it. The increase in investment in electric vehicles has been quite remarkable. Again, that's something where people have seen the market opportunity, and it's been coming through. Has the investment in the clean been anything like enough? The answer to that is a clear no, because emissions are still rising. So the challenge becomes to turn what is beginning into something which is happening at a much faster pace. And there it seems to me you've got a whole, and I went through a number of reasons why it's been too slow. I do think in emerging markets and developing economies, the cost of capital is absolutely critical. And I'll be going at some length tomorrow on how we bring down through the management of risk in terms of the investment process itself, through the management of risk through the financial markets, how we can start to bring down the cost of capital so that obstacle, which is, in my view, the biggest obstacle in emerging markets and developing economies, can be overcome. So it's not that it's not happening, it's that it's not happening fast enough, and I think we can see through an understanding of why it's not happening how we go forward. On the quantification of the benefits of ecosystems, there now, I think, is quite a lot of work beginning on that. My friend and colleague, Partha Dasgupta, did, I thought, a very useful review on the economics of biodiversity. There's quite a lot of work on that. I'm more than happy to discuss that. And you probably by now know the references better than I do. But the question you raise is of fundamental importance. We have to understand the benefits, and in particular, and I went quite fast through my bit on forests, we have to understand how those benefits can be realized. And there are various different ways of doing that. But it is going to be a sustained problem, because not all those benefits are going to be able to run through the returns to investors in a very direct way. So they're going to have to be different kinds of policies alongside appropriate use of incentive structures, which are going to be predicated on the answers to some of the questions that you've described. But I can't give you a one simple formula and say, this is how you evaluate ecosystems. You have to go through the examples and say, well, these are the services that are provided by the mangroves. You know, and then you can actually quantify the returns you get in terms of the blocking of storm surges. You can quantify the value of the carbon that they capture. You can quantify how they enhance the fisheries. So you have to get specific in terms of those examples. But there are quite a lot of examples of ways in which you can actually do that. But I can't give you a one-off formula, but we can work through examples together.
So using a meta-analysis would be kind of accurate?
Yours, yes. The trouble about meta-analyses is they're just sort of an aggregation of lots of things that people have done, and I think that has some value, but I think you have to look into the examples and look at the quality of the work and the issues around the examples, as opposed to treating every single paper like just one observation in the universe of papers. And that's what one of the problems with meta-studies. But They have their value. I don't want to be dismissive, but I think to look into the quality of the work and look into the examples and see what's an analogy to the kind of issue that you're trying to tackle is probably a good way forward. There's a very good paper that just has been put out by Patricia Ellen on the eco-transformation in Brazil as part of the run-up to COP30 in Brazil. I'm more than happy to link you up with that one.
Cameron, I don't know if you want to add anything.
Pretty comprehensive answers, but perhaps just a sentence on Amir's question, the second one about flows of private capital into clean. Obviously, Nick's right that we've seen much more private capital flow strongly into clean energy in the last, well, it's been growing strongly over the last decade, but also it's not enough. So what might move the needle? The way I always think about this is that money will go where money is made, or at least money will flow where investors expect it to be made. And so shaping those expectations or shaping the actual returns with policies in the real economy, I've always thought to be a more powerful set of solutions than, you know, relying on the good-hearted spirits of people with the ESG tick boxes and so on. Because actually, I mean, not that that's not useful and so on, but this is a scale problem. As Nick set out, we're talking trillions. Money has to be made from this transition, and one of the wonderful things that we're seeing is that it is now being made. Certainly, you know, in the City of London, it's much easier to invest in a solar farm or a wind farm than it is to invest in a coal's uninvestable. Oil and gas is getting pretty hard because the risk premium is so high, because you're wondering at what point does this become a stranded asset. So I think we're getting there, but changing the returns on the ground and then providing a policy framework that shapes expectations of those returns in the future is really important.
So Martin, I'm going to turn to you because you've got people online. You've got a couple of questions for us from the online audience?
I can give you one question. There's a sort of central theme again this evening. A lot of people are concerned about policy, how governments would need to bring the voting public along with them with these policy changes, especially when there's some opposition to transition from areas where it's part of the community's identity, such as coal mining communities in Poland. So to reiterate, it's how can policy change be made successful by encouraging the voting public to accept it?
Okay, why don't I pass that one to Nick, and then again Cameron can come in too if he wishes.
The understanding of consequences of inaction, understanding the nature of action, why it can lead to increases in standard of living across the board whilst you're at the same time managing the immense risks of climate change. That public discussion is enormously important, and that public discussion is something which happens in universities, it happens in schools. I think it should happen more in actually the political space than it does, but it happens there too. So participation in that discussion and informed participation in that discussion, including, you know, getting rid of the deeply misleading and fake arguments that you hear. But that discussion has to be had directly, and it is something which is, in any kind of democratic society, absolutely critical. In the case of coal mining communities, we've already been discussing that in terms of the management of the dislocation. You have to invest in people and places. And my own view, and I'm not alone in this, is that, for example, in the 1970s and late 1980s, we managed that extremely badly in the UK. And we should have invested much earlier and managed that change much better. As a community, and that should have come out of discussion with communities and participation. So there's no single answer to that story, but it is one which depends on informed public discussion. It depends on taking participation seriously. It depends on having responsibility for consequences of actions on your fellow citizens, and in particular in those cases, investing strongly in people and places.
Nick, if I could just offer a supplementary to that question is, very much people will say that the conversation is a very elite conversation right now. I doubt if you go into a pub somewhere in the north of England, from where I hail, that you'll get a lot of discussion of these issues. Is there a way of democratizing this discussion in a meaningful way so that we get greater openness of that discussion? Some people are in favor of things like citizens' assemblies and other such things, so that we don't just confine this conversation to a relatively narrow elite of people who obviously do care a lot about this. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's too strong, Tim. I mean, I've worked a lot in my life, as you know, nearly 50 years, actually 50 years now, in India, much of that in one Indian village. The understanding of climate change is not something that just flows from the elites, it flows now from experience. And the seen the way in which the rubby growing season has got shorter and shorter as temperatures shoot up much more quickly on the Indo-Gangetic Plain in April. Now it's March. And I think people do see that directly, particularly agricultural communities are understanding the reality of climate change. Fishing communities understand the reality of fish stocks running down, and not just overfishing, it's also climate change, and moving around. I think the direct experience, people understand wildfires, they understand storms and cyclones, and I think increasingly that understanding is not just an elite understanding. I think children learn it in schools, and rightly so. And again, that's right across the board. But that kind of public discussion and sharing of experience is absolutely fundamental. And I think it's actually too strong to think of it just as an elite concern. The people who suffer earliest and hardest from climate change are the poorest communities.
Cameron, I know you want to add anything.
I do. I think this is a really, really important question. And there are two studies that come to my mind, both excellent, I think, that really are enlightening. And I hope you already know about them, but I suspect you don't. So one is from a group at the OECD a few years ago, including former LSE man, Antoine de Chez-le-Prêtre. And they looked at, I think, around, if I remember correctly, around 40,000 people across 20 countries, and found around 80 to 90% of people agreed that climate change was a priority and needed some action. And it was a very nice study with good controls, etc., that showed that the things that moved the needle on what made people support a particular climate policy was when you could be clear about three things. What does it mean for them? Does it actually work? That's the really key thing. Does the policy work? And how does it affect the poor and the vulnerable? And if you could satisfy people of those three things, they would buy into the policy. And then more recently, a study including a former colleague at Oxford, Teodora Boneva, on what's called pluralistic ignorance. So this was 130,000 people across 125 countries, with the finding that 69% would pay 1% of their income to deal with climate change. 89% thought governments should do more, but those people thought that only 43% would pay. So the majority think they're in a minority. And I think this is quite important. People actually do want action, but we think we're in a minority. And sometimes making people aware that there are minority voices that are quite loud and strident in a room, but actually the majority is quiet and gets it and is on board, that's a really important insight to share and to reify.
Thank you. Okay, we've got time for another round of questions here. I'm sorry, some people will end up being disappointed, but I'll go over here. Okay, we start there, then we'll come forward to you in a moment. Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much for a great lecture. My question is, what would you advise an incoming Labour government to implement as the single most effective policy to both drive growth and reduce carbon emissions?
Okay, come forward, one along, there we are, thank you.
Thank you very much. My question is about GDP. There's a lot of debate around how is GDP going to be a good indicator for the future of growth. Do you have any insights about that? Is there any way we can think beyond GDP as it is at the moment? Or thank you.
And I'll take a question on the left here as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to get your views about what happened a few months ago in Germany with this project of banning the use of gas heaters to heat homes. So the German government wanted by 2035 to ban the use of these things and replace them with heat pumps. But somehow the project failed. I mean, the government had to backtrack. So it seems to me that the vast majority of people in Germany are fully aware of what is at stake. And Germany is a country where you can get access to finance at a relatively low cost. So what went wrong?
Okay, we'll take yours and then that, yeah. Just a quick question, yeah.
Me, Frank, I might remember me, who's happened to be German, and I wanted to actually comment on that. In Germany, a country where climate and environment is left, right, and center, it's mainstream. We have a green coalition government, 20% of people vote green. Last year, the demand for electric vehicles collapsed after the government withdrew its subsidies, and the fastest growing segment of cars are SUVs and sport cars, and the average emissions are actually rising in Germany. That is the country which is as much aware of these issues as any other country, I imagine, and it's not happening. And it's the same point here, the number of people buying new gas heating systems has exploded once the government nearly imploded over that policy measure. So I'm much more skeptical regarding what the public will take It comes to a point you made regarding Tony Blair, and it comes to a point you made early on. A big part of the investment has to come from the private sector. I don't think the private sector, especially the households, are prepared or capable of doing that, and it will mainly fall back on government through taxation, which obviously is paying the public paying again, just indirectly.
Okay, so back to Nick and Cameron. Yeah.
So, incoming Labour government. I'm a crossbencher in the Lords. I don't have any party affiliation, but I'm on the record as speaking up quite strongly against what the vacillation of the current government, and that has undermined confidence in investment. I would prioritise investment in the grid, expanding the grid and decarbonising the grid. I would prioritise the insulation of homes, making them much more energy efficient. Tremendous returns on those investments. The challenges are that actually helping make it happen, bringing down the cost of capital, and overcoming some of the obstacles to actually doing it in terms of the availability of skilled labour and so on. So those are the kinds of areas that I would put big priority on. I think the charging infrastructure for electric vehicles will be very important in terms of their adoption. So there's a whole range of issues that would constitute very strong investment, which would drive growth and bring down emissions and make our cities much more livable and breathable. And I think they should do that quickly and at the beginning of the government. So that's the advice I would give, but emphasising that I'm not an advisor to the Labour Party. The question about GDP, I did actually cover that quite extensively yesterday, so if you go and look at the slides from yesterday, if you look back to the origins of GDP, it was really around the Great Depression, around Keynesian economics, about the work of Keynes and Kuznets and so on. And it was there to measure the level of activity, and particularly associated with the demand for labour. It's not really a welfare measure. It didn't originate as a welfare measure. It has some aspects of relationship with income, which does count. But if you look at the Millennium Development Goals of adopted around the millennium, it was health and education particularly that were very strong there in addition to GDP. If you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, then sustainability and inequality are much bigger in those than they were in the Millennium Development Goals. So those are the kind of indicators that I think we should use alongside GDP, because it does have its function in terms of demand for labour, pressure on output, influence of, you know, the way in which inflation comes about and so on. So I'm not saying get rid of GDP, but I would say it's at best a modest measure of welfare, and there are many more direct measures that we can and should use, and to be fair, that we are also using and have been for a while. But certainly don't make GDP into a fetish, but I hope we're past that, at least we should be. In terms of take-up, there are going to be some periods where things go up and things go down. If you look at the railways in the United States in the 19th century, a lot of them went bust, right? There are going to be booms and busts, steps forward and step back. But if you look at the way in which costs are moving, I was very clear, and the evidence is very clear, that the cost of heat pumps is dropping very rapidly. The cost of the storage of electricity is dropping very rapidly. Heat pumps are going to outcompete gas boilers pretty soon. If you push people into installing the heat pumps before they've got really cost competitive with gas boilers, then you expect to run into those problems. But these are about managing the transition, and it's extremely important that the clean becomes cheaper than the dirty. That requires investment, it requires support. One of the reasons that solar panels dropped so rapidly in price was the support which the German government gave to them in the early stages, which increased scale. It was China that responded particularly to that increase in demand. So the difficulties you describe are real difficulties. Are they terminal difficulties? Obviously not, because the direction of travel of the prices of the cleaner. And we've learned, I hope, something about the importance of two things. One is the cost of capital, and the other is making it easier. Because the cost of capital to the private individual who has to make some of those investments is not the same as the level, the cost at which the German government can borrow, which is extremely low, as we know. But that's not the price that individuals pay on their own capital market transactions. And the same will be true of electric vehicles. Their purchase price is already very close, and the cost over the lifetime of the car is already lower than an electric vehicle. It's a question of the transition, of the charging, of making it as easy as possible. But are the obstacles that you described insurmountable? Absolutely not. Are they temporary? Yes, they are.
Cameron, we're more or less out of time. Did you have anything you'd like to add?
Of course, but I'm happy to see you, Tim.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I just really remains for me to thank everyone for coming this evening, for sharing their views, and for particularly, though, to Nick and to Cameron for outlining a range of really important issues for debate. And the one message I want to just reinforce is we are part of an important debate. We've got to make this an open discussion, but also to win the hearts and minds of those who are going to be very much part of the transition that you're describing. And I think one of the great things about being here at LSE is we play a key role in contributing to those important policy discussions. And what could be a better example of that than listening to you this evening? So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.